Big show for you here today. It is another edition of Mock Draft Monday. And this time we got Dane Brugler of The Athletic. Yes, the author, the creator of The Beast himself in the chair to give us his five favorite player to team fits from his most recent mock draft. Got some awesome ones to dive into today. We've got a big time landing spot in the top 10 for Carnell Tate and a great discussion about the landscape of wide receivers right now. We've got two Indiana Hoosiers going on day two of the NFL draft, two pretty ideal landing spots with the caveat for the receiver pick there. All that and more coming on today's show. Let's get into it. What's going on, everyone? I'm Matt Harmon. Welcome to the Yahoo Fantasy Forecast, and it is a hell of a day to talk ball. It's a big day as we head closer and closer to the NFL draft. We've got a big time mock draft Monday for you here today because it is the man, the myth, the legend himself, Mr. Beast in the flesh. It is our guy, Dane Brugler. Dane, what's going on, buddy?
Hey, man, this is fun to do. We do it, what, a week before the draft almost every year? And so I was just mentioning before the show how if you could make the draft come tomorrow, that'd be great. I enjoy talking about it, obviously. But I don't know. I'm close to that wall where we're close, and it's just needs to get here.
Again, as I said to you before, I sort of feel you on that. In that, number one, I do love post draft analysis, so especially with wide receivers. Like now, I actually know how this guy's going to fit into the room. Even one of the guys we're going to talk about today, I'm really going to be fascinated to see where he lands because it will kind of give me clues on whether I like the landing spot or not, or whether I think he's going to be used correctly. I do love that part. At the same time, I've got about 10 more prospects that I want fully written up on the website before we get kicked off here. So I do kind of need those 10 days. But for people like you, Dane, who are locked in all year long to the draft, I totally get it why you're ready for this thing to get here. But we've got a fun show ahead of us here today on Mock Draft Monday. If you watch us and you listen to us every single week, you know what we do here. We bring in the best of the best in the draft industry. And Dane is certainly among that crowd. And we get them to give us their five favorite player to team fits from their most recent mock draft, plus a prospect they're willing to stand on the table for. So no further ado, let's get right into it. Welcome to another edition of Mock Draft Monday. All right, Dane, let's hear it. Who is your first favorite player to team fit from this most recent mock?
So it's nothing that I don't think people haven't seen before, but Carnell Tate at number eight to the New Orleans Saints. Look, we know Saints can't pass an Ohio State receiver, right? So there's that. Mm. There's that part of this. But they need to address the position in some shape or fashion in this draft. Just looking at the depth chart, that's, I think, a fair way to look at it. But also, you have Tyler Shuck. Who is Tyler Shuck, a long-term answer or a short-term, guy that you can get through and you can win some games? Is he the long-term solution for this team? And in order to figure that out, you need some more help at the pass catchers where he can throw to and you can really get a feel for him as a quarterback. And I think Tate, just the way he would fit in that offense, because the thing you love about Tate is, yeah, he can win vertically. You watch the highlight package and some of his best plays are down the field. But the strides he made this year from his 2024 tape to 2025 tape in the short to intermediate game, the route running, how controlled he is. And then, this is something I'll be interested to hear if maybe you noticed this. But something that I noticed just watching Carnell Tate throughout the season this past year, he's one of the better sideline receivers that I've scouted the last, 5, 6, 7 years. And I mean that in respect to the way that he can work along the white, but also how long he is. And he pulls some of those throws that are out of bounds in bounds. And so that catch radius we're talking about, I think on the sidelines is where you really see it. And so I don't want to peg Tate as he is definitely this, definitely that. I like that three level ability and the way that can impact the Saints offense.
No, I do kind of share your affinity with him as a sideline player because I've said this is my line about Tate throughout the course of the draft season, is that he's just a very aesthetically pleasing player to watch catch the football. And part of that, Dane, is because he is a guy that just always like catches the ball away from his frame. He's never one of these guys, unless he absolutely has to protect the football. Like, he's never one of these guys that's bringing it into his body. He rarely ever like needlessly underhand attacks it. It's always just that kind of perfect diamond away from his frame, which is why his contested catch numbers are so good. It's why his drop rate, I believe, was, depending on how you look at it, a 0% last year. I mean, he's so good at that. And that's a big part of it too, man, is like he, again, increases that catch radius. So I think this particular fit here too with Tyler Shuck, one of the things I really liked watching about Shuck last year is that he really did just play some big boy quarterback, and that even if he was in the gun, like he would throw the ball from the far hash, like to the boundary outside the numbers. And I like Olave doing that, and Olave does more than that, but I think Carnell Tate actually would be a pretty significant upgrade over certainly some of the other guys they have on the roster.
Yeah, I mean, Mason Tipton was one of my favorite late round gems last year, and I think he's done a nice job in the, you know, limited action we've seen. But they need some upgrades, and I think this is one of the ways they could go. Obviously, they could go with a pass rusher here, or maybe a corner, keep Mansoor Delane in the state of Louisiana, and then look to address the position on day two. But I tell you, Tate, it'd be tough to pass on him. And even if Tate's gone, if say Tate goes six to the Browns, wide receiver two is very much in play at number eight. Whether that's Jordan Tyson, it could be Mekhi Lemon. I think that the Saints really want to figure out that wide receiver two spot at number eight in the first round.
Yeah, I certainly think so. And I think when you look at the history of Saints wide receivers, and especially some of the moves that this current group has made, you know, they've traded for Devon Vele. Obviously, they gave up a lot to get Vele, but they traded for Devon Vele. They were a team that was, they were the team that I think the Lions jumped to get Isaac Tesla last year in the third round. Mm-hmm. They traded for Jalen Polk towards the end of the preseason to bring him in. They clearly are looking for bodies at that position. And I would also say that the through line there, Dane, of those three players, they're bigger guys, even if they don't play on the perimeter, where Tate will absolutely play on the perimeter. I think is he not your number one wide receiver ranking in this class as well? Yeah, same. Like and it's because he fits all 32 NFL offenses, because he can just play on the perimeter in that way. Do you think that he fits sort of those thresholds? Like, how do you weigh that when you're trying to pair teams and players, when you look at some of the history of, like, they have gone for some of these bigger wide receivers, and Mickey Loomis has obviously been there forever. How do you sort of weigh that when you're looking at these potential fits here?
Yeah, and obviously you always try to track tendencies. Certain teams have certain thresholds, whether it's offensive linemen, whether it's corners and arm length, receivers and size, and sometimes they go off the reservation a little bit, and they will color outside the lines with some of these examples. So it's not like a hard and fast type of thing, but it does, I think, point you in the right direction. And kind of like what you're saying, like it's hard to see a team just being out on Carnell Tate, right? Because what team could not use a player like this who, like I said, can win all three levels, the 4-5, I think it's interesting that, like the Browns, for example, you know, one of the reasons they passed on McMillan in the top 10 last year, they didn't have a full athletic testing profile. That's not the only reason, but it's one of the reasons. I think they had a higher grade on Mason Graham, but one of the reasons is all he did was run a 40-yard dash, and he ran a 4.53. Okay. Carnell Tate this year, all he did testing-wise, 40-yard dash, ran a 4.53. And so it'll be interesting just to see how the Browns and several of these teams look at that, and not having the full athletic testing picture. But that's, I think, more nitpicking than anything. You're trusting the tape. And yeah, did Jeremiah Smith just draw coverage? No question. But there are plenty of examples on tape where you're seeing Carnell Tate getting double covered, having to create a window that was maybe not there, or was so small that he had to go and make a play. There's a place for a Carnell Tate on almost all 32 rosters.
Exactly. And I mean, even as teams are taking their number one receivers and you know, moving them around the formation. I think the Saints did a really good job of this with Chris Olave, where in Clint Kubiak's offense the year before, he primarily played more outside and on the ball than ever before in his NFL career, and certainly more than he did last year. This past year, Chris Olave, which has happened with other receivers like CeeDee Lamb and Kellen Moore's offense, it's happened with guys like Devontae Smith in Philadelphia, like his slot rate went up. And that's, I think, how you want to use a guy like this, move him around the formation and get him those matchups for a guy like Olave. Well, the best way to do that, Dane, is like you got to have somebody that's going to do the, you know, kind of what's almost become the dirty work now at wide receiver, which is you got to line up outside on the ball and run against a bunch of physical press man coverage. And for Tate, 77.3% success rate versus man coverage is the seventh best mark I've charted since the 2021 draft class. Like, he clearly passes the threshold there of what you're looking for is that boundary receiver. Last thing before we move away from this particular pick here, how do you view this wide receiver class as a whole? I know it's obviously not, we don't necessarily, I think everybody says we don't have like one of the big boys like a Neighbors or obviously Marvin Harrison Jr. when he came out, but just with Tate clearly established as the top guy, can you kind of just bucket that for people historically where you kind of view him as a prospect?
Yeah, for me, Tate's not as high of a grade as McMillan was last year, but I think he would have been number two behind McMillan, or I guess if we're including Hunter in that conversation, three behind T-Mac. But no, I mean, you're right. Like, there isn't that Malik Neighbors in this class where it's just like, okay, well, this guy's an obvious top five pick. I don't care what draft we're talking about. But in this class specifically, it's just interesting when we know receivers are going to go, right? I mean, you look around at some of the contracts being put out there, the opportunity to get these guys on rookie deals and the impact that can make is why wide receiver is going to be one of the most, if not the most, drafted position almost every single year. And this year, the volume is there in terms of the number of picks, number of wide receivers that will be picked first round, second round, third round. And it's just, it comes down to most classes where, you know, what's your favorite flavor? You know, what exactly are you looking for? I think, like I said, Tate pretty much fits everybody, you know, or you're going to change what you do just to make sure that he does fit. Whereas, you know, maybe Mekhi Lemon isn't a perfect fit for everybody because of just how little bit different he is. Omar Cooper Jr., I think he has inside-outside versatility, but he might be just a little bit different than what teams are looking for specifically at the position. So, yeah, it's funny. We lump all these guys together, but whether, you know, X, Y, Z, and whether they're blended together, they're all a little bit different. And so I am pretty excited about some of the day two receivers in this class. Some of them are pretty fun. It'll be great looking back 2-3 years from now to see, okay, how did Ted Hurst develop, you know, out of Georgia State? What year one look like? Then what year two and year three look like? You know, I think guys like Dejon Stribling from Ole Miss, who I think surprised a lot of people when he ran that 4.36 at the 40-yard in the 40-yard dash at the combine. You know, there's a good chance he ends up in the second round. So it's a fun wide receiver class where the order is going to look a little bit different from team to team in terms of how they have them stacked. And it'll be fun to see how they actually are drafted on Friday and Thursday and Friday night of the draft.
Yeah, I think Friday will be a big wide receiver night. I could certainly see some guys, obviously, a good amount of them going in the first round. I think that will happen. But I'm really excited about the Friday group as well, because that's where you sort of get into the pick your flavor fun of this wide receiver class. Just to put a finer point on the end of this discussion, you mentioned just the what guys are making at the wide receiver position right now. Tedaro McMillan last year, just under $7 million average per year salary, which obviously Tate would be right around this if he was picked eighth overall. These are some wide receivers who are making more on a per year basis than Tedaro McMillan. Jahan Dotson, I still got a little candle lit for Jahan Dotson. I was a big favorite of mine.
Yep.
I just did a big video for my YouTube channel, Dane, where I look back at like five of my biggest misses recently, and I had to make fun of myself for Jahan Dotson while still admitting that I'm a little excited to see his opportunity this year. But anyways, point being, Jahan Dotson, Josh Palmer, Jalen Naylor, Darius Slayton, and let's go ahead and give this like the Harmon missed on this guy, you know, sandwich here, Rashad Bateman. These are the players who will be making more money than Carnell Tate, this upcoming season. So even if Tate is the number two receiver, theoretically, for the New Orleans Saints, is still a pretty good value at the 8th overall pick. But let's get to your second favorite player to team fit here. Really excited to hear your thoughts on this player.
Okay, so this is Buffalo Bills. I pick 26, taking Malachi Lawrence, the edge rusher from UCF. And I think this is the type of edge rusher I wanted them to draft. And they've kind of gone away from it a little bit, where they've gone after, obviously, Von Miller and free agency. And but when it comes to the draft, they're more of the AJ Epinesa and Basham, and the bigger pass rushers. Just give me a guy with a little more juice, and Malachi Lawrence certainly has that. He's closer to the 255 mark in terms of weight and size, but that 40 inch vert, the 4.5 240, the 10 yard split, his and he's not super bendy, but his ability to get off the ball and really threaten the quarterback, that's something that I think this team has been missing. And so with that, Buffalo is always picking in the 20s, it seems like, and it's always a kind of a mystery. All right, is Dalton Kincaid gonna fall to them? Is this and this year I think there's enough pass rushers at the end of the first where they're gonna find somebody they like if they go that direction. But I would love to see that pairing with Lawrence and Buffalo.
And if you look at the consensus board on, like mock draft database, Malachi Lawrence is not necessarily in that first round range. He's kind of hovered in those like 40th overall picks and stuff like that. Yet you're the second person we've had on Mock Draft Monday that's been like, I don't know, I think this guy is probably going to go in the first round here. And I really like your pairing of him with Buffalo at the 26th pick, because you kind of hinted at this, like Buffalo is never going to be bad enough. And, Brandon being in one of his, maybe you shouldn't have said this moments, he's like, well, we're not bad enough to ever get like a Jamar Chase on our team, talking about the Bengals a few years ago. He is spiritually correct about that. Like, they're probably never going to be bad enough to pick fifth overall. And yet that kind of almost increases the need, Dane, at 26 to really shoot for the ceiling here. And Malachi Lawrence, based on everything I've seen from him and everything you kind of read about him, he's certainly one of those ceiling-based bets here.
Right, exactly. And I mean, there's some things about Lawrence that, like I said, he's not super bendy. So there's a little bit of an upright play style about him, both as a pass rusher and as a run defender. He never had more than 7 sacks in any one year, which, I think, especially for a fifth-year senior, you just want a little bit more. And the production, not the be-all, end-all, but still, it's something that you want to see, maybe a little bit more dominance out of a player like this. Now, if you throw on the Baylor tape, you could pick and choose, and, if showed you his 15 best plays, you're all in. But from just a body of work standpoint, you wish maybe is a little bit better. But I think that there's still some upside here. It just feels like the jump he made year to year feels like he's trending in the right direction, and his ability to weaponize his length and just the play urgency that he has, that competitiveness, is something that I would want to bet on. And like I said, with Buffalo, getting more juice off the edge that is going to help you get after the quarterback, help put pressure on the quarterback. To me, that's something that they need, and something that I think Lawrence can do. And there's a lot of names at this level of the draft, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's Cassius Howell or R. Mason Thomas or T.J. Parker, Zion Young, there's a lot of pass rushers in that late first, early second round window. But for me, and when I look specifically at Buffalo, I think Lawrence has been kind of that guy where just plug him in. I think that's the one guy they've been missing.
Yeah, and this is a defense that is likely undergoing some significant changes with Sean McDermott out and Jim Leonard in as the defensive coordinator now, with Joe Brady as the head coach. Like, I think this will be a pretty interesting draft to sort of see just how much the front office has maybe been catering to the coaching staff with some of these picks over the last few years, and how those philosophies are going to sort of diverge here. You've mentioned some of the guys that they've targeted previously. This would be a pretty big departure from that. So that would tell us a lot. And like, this is the thing, Dane, teams can never, they can lie to us all they want with their words, but they can't lie to us with draft picks and with money that they spend. So I think this would send a pretty clear message from the new Buffalo Bills brain trust.
Yeah, to your point, it'll be interesting when obviously you have a head coaching change and but the same GM. You know, obviously the GM, the good GMs, they draft for what the coaching staff wants. They draft for what's going to fit specifically for their vision for, and so I think you're 100% correct. Buffalo is a little bit of a changing of the guard moment here. And how does Bean adjust the way that they draft? It's all about collaboration. I mean, that's what the winning teams do. And having that head coach and GM connection is so important on draft weekend. So yeah, I think you're right. That'll be really interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah, they're just straight up one of the most interesting teams to watch this year because of that. And it's like half of a new day in Buffalo, and yet some of the same characters are obviously going to be remaining with the team. We're going to go outside of the first round here with your third favorite player to team fit. So let's hear it. What do you got here?
So in my mock draft, I had some trading around, and the Cowboys ended up with 39th pick, early second round. And I have them drafting Trayden Stukes, the nickel from Arizona. And I think Stukes has been a player that has been well-traveled this spring because a lot of teams are interested. They want to find out more about him. He's been on a lot of 30 visits, a lot of workouts. And, you know, I think based off of the season that he had, based off of the combine that he had, I totally understand why. And I think when you look at the Cowboys specifically, this is the type of player they could really use in the nickel. You know, Deron Bland, who had that great, well, 2023 now? Gosh, I mean, that big time interception season that he had is further away in the rear view than I think we would like to believe. But I think they want to keep him outside. I think he wants to stay outside. Obviously, Siobhan Revelle, they're hoping for a big step in year two. The rookie last year who's coming off the knee injury. But they still need that nickel. And I think they need, and you think of that Christian Parker defense, I think of versatility. I think he really likes those hybrid guys that depending, you know, gives you nickel flex, gives you dime flex. You know, you can make these adjustments based off of what the offense is showing you, and you don't have to feel like you're out of position. Because that's what, I mean, so much of the NFL game right now is about mismatches and trying to get the other, the offense is trying to get the defense into a spot they don't want to be in, and it's the same thing. And a guy like Stukes gives you a little bit of versatility that you can make adjustments on the fly. And this is why I think the Cowboys are a Caleb Downs team at number 12, but mm-hmm. if they don't go that direction, a guy like Stukes in the second round, I think makes a ton of sense.
So in this scenario, did you have the Cowboys still keeping their first two first round picks, and then did they end up in 30? Like, how did that work out?
So yeah, because this mock comes out Wednesday, so it hasn't even it's not out there yet. But I did have picks 12 and 20 going to the Browns at 6 for picks 6 and 39, and so for the Cowboys, I think it makes sense because they're going up to 6 to get. They're not going to wait at 12 and hope the guy they want falls them. They're going to go up to 6 and get him, and then it costs you both first round picks, but you get back in the second round now. Because they didn't have they currently don't have a second round pick. And so I think the player that they could get at 20 isn't all that different than the player they're going to get at 39. I think they'll have those guys pretty closely ranked. And so in this scenario, going with a guy like Stukes at 39, I think really helps their secondary from day one. It's another older player. Stukes is going to be a 25-year-old rookie, former walk-on, someone that's played corner, played safety, but really played his best this past year as a nickel.
Yeah, obviously for a guy that's really athletic and somebody that is it perfectly kind of encapsulates that Christian Parker defense. And you know, this is going to be a talking point throughout the course of the draft, and it probably has been throughout the offseason already, is that like, can Christian Parker find his Cooper DeJean? You know, like this is how this always goes. Former coach, like, hit this role in the defense, even though it's like, yeah, that probably existed because Cooper DeJean is really awesome. Nevertheless, like, you do still need this type of player to really make this defense go. So that makes a lot of sense. And I also love that you have them trading up into the top 10, because I think you hit on two big themes about this draft with this, essentially the Cowboys trying to fix their defense here in one strike, which is one, like, at 12, there's probably a pretty significant drop off to the guys that are going to go early on in the draft. You know, I do think, like, Like, how many true first round grades do you actually have in this class, Dane?
I have 14, you know, but it, like, okay. And that's even fudging it a little bit. Like,
sure.
Like, I think Mekhi Lemon's my last first round grade. And mm-hmm. I like the tape so much that I'm just going to, even though I don't, you know, the profile isn't traditionally what I would give a first round grade to. I love the tape that much. But to the Cowboys sitting at 12, they might be stuck in a spot where, you know, it's Venga Yawane and, you know, some good players there. But, you know, we did this last year where they were kind of, they struck out. And so they went with Tyler Booker, who really good player, upgrades their offensive line, but I don't think was option A, B, or C with who they were hoping would fall to them. And so this is a team with a win now window. And I won't be surprised at all if they get aggressive to maybe make sure they get, whether it's Sonny Styles, Caleb Downs, one of these pass rushers, whoever it may be, won't be surprised at all if they're a little aggressive to make sure they go get them.
Right. If it's 14 true first round grades for you, yeah, one of them will be available at 12. But yeah, what if it's Mekhi Lemon? Like, they don't necessarily, depending on what's going to happen with George Pickens, like, theoretically, they don't need another receiver. Right. Especially, they don't really need, like, a slot-based player because they have CeeDee Lamb to be doing all that stuff. Like, Ryan Flournoy gave him some really good reps as a movement Z slot option last year. So, it says that's difficult there for this team where if you get up into the top to really take one of these potential big defensive difference makers, that's a key theme. And as you mentioned, because of the lack of, like, true first-round grades, there's a flattening from, I don't know, pick 15, 20, all the way down to 40, 45, and you're taken kind of from the same pool there. So I think in one fell swoop here, Dane, you told the listeners and the viewers like two big lessons about the draft, all while making it about a very popular team, the Dallas Cowboys. So that's a good job by you.
I mean, hey, blind squirrel. Like, they're interesting because I they need a linebacker in a big way. Like, I don't know that there's someone on the roster right now they feel 100% comfortable wearing that green dot. And so, okay, do we go get a Sonny Styles? How do we feel about Jacob Rodriguez? You know, but we don't have that second round pick. So will we take a linebacker at 20 if we don't get Styles at 12? So there's just a lot of different ways they could attack this. And I think that's what makes the Cowboys one of the more interesting teams on Thursday night of the draft, just to see their plan and how aggressive they get.
Oh, the TV producers across the country are just so excited that you just said that. So there's no doubt more excitement is building for this NFL draft. We're going to take our first quick break here on Mock Draft Monday. When we come back, we've got two more day two picks for Dane to highlight. We'll get into those guys right after this. All right, we're back. We're continuing to roll through today's edition of Mock Draft Monday, actually live here, which is super exciting. And now we're going into day two, more day two picks with Dane Brugler here. So, Dane, give us your fourth favorite player to team fit from your most recent mock.
All right, so at pick 50, Detroit Lions have them going to the secondary. They need depth. Nobody knows that more than the Lions about defensive depth, especially in the back end. D'Angelo Ponce, corner from Indiana, and I'm not going to bring up biting the kneecaps and all that. It's overplayed, but D'Angelo Ponce is just a perfect culture fit and competitive fit for Coach Campbell and what they want to be in that building in that organization. Obviously they've worked with smaller corners in the past. Like, I don't think it's something where they only want bigger guys. And you know, ideally, sure, would you like D'Angelo Ponce to be 2 inches taller? Sure, but give me the competitive fight that he plays with. The speed's not a question. The ball skills are there, and I love so much about who he is as a player and the way he competes and the way he did it as a freshman at James Madison, freshman All-American, goes to Indiana, same exact thing the last 2 years. And he was such a big part of that national championship run. It was very much a team effort. Mendoza deserves all the credit that goes his way. Very much a team effort with Indiana this year. And D'Angelo Ponce is a big part of that.
Yeah, when you sent over this particular player to highlight and go into the Lions here for this pod, I was like, oh, this is so perfect. I mean, because Ponce absolutely screams like Dan Campbell, you know, Brad Holmes, just like the whole culture, the whole ethos of the Lions. Like, he is an aggressive player, just super tenacious as a corner there. Now, you mentioned it, obviously 5'9", 182 pounds. Do you see him as a guy that can play some outside, or is he more pure nickel for you?
I think he can play inside, outside. I mean, I think, you know, so often we see a smaller corner, and I think the automatic, and not you, I think just all of us, we think, oh, smaller corner, like, okay, we need to move him inside. That's where he's going to be better fit. And I think he can do it, but I think his play style is of an outside corner with the way that he likes to play and mix things up. And whether it's playing man-to-man, whether he's pressing, whether he's playing off, I just think his play style, while could move inside, I think it very much fits outside as well. And so I you know, looking at the Lions, like I said, nobody knows more than the Lions that how important that secondary depth is. And that's why, you know, I could see him drafting a safety early. I could see him, you know, there's a lot of positions they could go, even on the defensive line. Corner is one of those positions they need to look at. You know, the Terrion Arnold stuff, doesn't mm-hmm. seem to be anything to it, but it's still something that, you know, even before that, like, corner's a position they need to look at. And I think Pons just fits perfectly. Again, the size is what it is, but he's always been smaller, right? It's not like he woke up one day and was smaller than everyone else and he had to figure out, okay, how do I do this? He's always been a smaller guy. And so he's always figured out how to, you know, the rest of his skill set, how that had to be heightened because of making up for those lack of inches in terms of his height. So big fan of Pons as a player, and a big fan, if he gets to 50, to me, he should be off the board earlier than 50. But if he makes it the Lions mid-second round, I just love that fit.
Well, and, you know, that 43.5-inch vertical that we showed there on the screen, like, yeah, that is a big part of him making up for the lack of just true height. Right. And he makes plays on the ball. He breaks up passes. He is a very impressive player that I think increases the window that you got to throw into for just how massive of a leaper he is. He makes that difficult to defend there. And I'll never forget this, Dane. It was a couple of years ago. I think it was the Sam Darnold meltdown game in Week 18 against the Vikings, where the Lions took Amik Robertson, who's like 5'9", 187 pounds, yeah, and they had him track Justin Jefferson around the field in that game and had some great success too. Again, obviously Sam Darnold was having issues under pressure, the whole deal, but like, they had some real success doing that. Robertson obviously is no longer on the team. That's a part of why they do need defensive back help. But it just kind of goes to show your point. They're totally willing to take these smaller bodies and say, hey, if you have the mindset, if you are ready to rock, you know, to play physical against a big boy receiver, like, we'll look beyond the measurables. And kind of going off that point too, mentioning like looking past the measurables, this is sort of something I've been wrestling with all throughout draft season, Dane, is that like the game is changing so much that your typical like nickel corner, like these smaller guys who, you know, were really good in like man-to-man coverage, stuff like that, there's not really an easy fit for those players on the inside anymore, because the slot receivers are getting bigger now. Like, we've got these power slot bodies, we've got these 12 personnel packages and stuff, and teams are running against a lot of those looks anyway. So in a way, you're almost kind of like taking Pons, and maybe he would maybe not even be best deployed in the slot as a corner, because the size and dimensions show you that. Like, I think his game might actually be better expressed outside anyways.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And I mean, DJ Reed is already on this roster. And so I think maybe that's one of the arguments why they should go for more size, because they already have one of those smaller guys on the roster. That's a pretty, you know, big part of what they do. And yeah, the having under 30 inch arms for a corner it's going to be a deal breaker for some teams. Some teams are going to see that lack of size, whether you're going to use them inside or outside, and say, okay, under 30 inch arms, we're just not going to go that direction. We're going to let somebody else make that pick. And I get it. I understand, especially at a corner is a very much a stopwatch position. It's a measuring tape position, more so than maybe some other positions where you can sacrifice a little bit of size, sacrifice a little bit of speed. Corner, it's tougher because of just those inches matter so much. And every little tenth of a second matter that much on the stopwatch at that position. And I just think Pons has found enough ways to overcome the lack of size, where whether it's inside, whether it's outside, he understands, timing, route anticipation. He understands how to be there when the ball arrives. I mean, throwing on the Miami tape from the national championship game, did that multiple times where he understood based off of, you know, pre-snap what route was coming. And so he was there when the ball arrived to break it up. 3 years in college, he led the team in passes defended all 3 years. James Madison for the first year and then Indiana the last 2 years. And so generally, maybe this isn't my type of corner, but I just, the competitive DNA that he plays with, to me, that's the difference maker, where I'm going to trust the tape a little bit more than I would generally with a player this size.
A lot of smart, tough, tenacious players on that Indiana team this past year, which perfectly transitions us to our next favorite player to team fit here, another one of those Indiana Hoosiers that won the national championship.
Yeah, so for this last one, third round, pick 67 for the Raiders, have him going Elijah Surratt, wide receiver from Indiana. And you tell me, is this too much same with Jack Besh, like who they drafted on day two last year? There's a little bit of overlap there, but I think that obviously part of the reason you do it is the connection with your rookie quarterback and what that means for just not only the success of your offense, but bringing your young quarterback along. The connection they had was just so special at Indiana. The back shoulder throws, the timing. Mendoza deserves a lot of credit for that. But if you're not in lockstep with your receiver and the receiver is not just understanding of each one of those steps and the pacing that's involved, it's just not going to work. But it seems like every single time they were on point. And I think I would love to see that connection carry over to the NFL.
Yeah, there's no doubt that you just see it on paper. You're like, oh yeah, let's keep the connection going. Like, let's keep the good times rolling between these two guys, because they had a real special thing on that back shoulder connection, especially. And just throughout the course of the entire season, Elijah Surratt and Fernando Mendoza were on fire together. So in that way, it is really appealing. You mentioned the Besh thing. Like, that was my second thought, though, and this will get me to some of my Elijah Surratt sort of evaluation, is that I think Besh, obviously, I think we can clearly look back on the season and see that there were members of the coaching staff that just never wanted Jack Besh to begin with, and they never really did anything to put him in position to do what I think he would do best, which is probably work as a big slot player in what should have been Chip Kelly's offense and maybe will be in this offense too, which is kind of what I think Elijah Surratt needs to be too. Like, when I look at guys like Elijah Surratt who fall below the 35th percentile in success rate versus man and press coverage and reception perception, I have a whole breakdown coming out on this later this week. Almost all the guys that become true high volume hits from that bucket, I mean, the vast majority of them get cut on the rookie contract. Even if they're drafted on the first or second day of the NFL draft, the vast majority of them get cut on their rookie contract. Like, they end up being what you would consider a flame out. But the guys who've been high volume hits, they go on to become these big slot players that didn't necessarily separate consistently against man press in college, but were really good zone beaters, which, you tell me, when I watch Elijah Surratt read out and work against zone coverage, that's where he really separates well, where he presents a really strong target. So I'd kind of, if I'm an NFL coaching staff, and I don't know if you've talked to anyone who kind of has this opinion, but this is just where I'm at, I would love to see him moved into kind of like an Amon-Ra St. Brown type of role, a Juju Smith-Schuster role from early in his career, where he's working across from a dominant number one. So that's sort of where I think he'd be best expressed. But the other guys who hit from this list too, Dane, are kind of what I would call, volatile deep threat receivers, which is, I think, what he would be if he was a perimeter player, just because he's not going to always give you that separation. But we've already seen proof of concept that he can be that guy with the quarterback that the Raiders will be taking first overall.
Right. I think last year he had only one catch of 30 plus yards in the air. And so to what you're saying about just having more of a ceiling as a deep threat, I think is absolutely right. He ran a 4.53 at the pro day, didn't run the combine, which is, I think fine for him based off of what you watch on film. I think that's okay. Yeah, makes sense. but I think that he has, and because he's a former Hooper who, you know, he kind of grew up as a basketball focused guy, made that transition, and, you know, always interested with guys that move up through, you know, especially in today's college football, how common it is for guys to move around, transfer, but starting out at St. Francis, then going to James Madison, then Indiana, like just seeing him be productive at every one of those levels and not seeing that drop off at all, really. I think is, and then the touchdown production, like this guy was such a big part. He had 44 touchdown grabs in four seasons in college, just crazy touchdown production that, you know, is a kind of a selling point that you mentioned that in a war room and, you know, GM's ears perk up. So, but one of the reasons I love the fit, the main reason I love the fit is the connection with the quarterback. And not only for, like, I still think Surratt's, he might never be a 1,000-yard receiver in the NFL, but in terms of helping and, you know, that quarterback, that rookie quarterback come along and a familiar face that he's throwing to, Mendoza will be fine regardless, in my opinion. But still, if you can draft a receiver that you like, plus we know the quarterback likes, it might be a win-win for everybody.
Right. And I still obviously have a lot of hope for Jack Besh, but the rookie year was not good. Like, I mean, that's a problem, too. I mean, I think when you watched him, he was fine, but he just didn't produce. Now, again, the environment was terrible, but still, you want to just give yourself some options here. You want to give yourself a lot of potential paths to finding a productive receiver because you clearly did not have very many last year. So I think with Surratt, he's just one of these guys that I'm, because he knows how to win against zone coverage, I am confident that he is a good football player. Like, I'm confident that whoever takes him will get a good football player. But in terms of the production ceiling, I think there are probably other spots. We haven't said the name Brock Bowers either, by the way. Like, Brock Bowers is going to do a lot of kind of big slot things, obviously, in this offense. Yeah. Like, he'll be detached from the formation a lot. I think there are probably, even though he's got the connection with Mendoza, which obviously is appealing and will create for some big plays, there are probably other spots, Dane, where I think his production ceiling would be best expressed as like an off-ball receiver at 6'2", 210, because I've tried to do this with other guys, Dane, you know, the Keon Coleman's, the Jaden Higgins, like, well, what if, based on this guy, like, how could he be a big slot? Those guys are almost, and you tell me if I'm stupid for saying this, those guys are almost like too big to be big slots, but like 6'2", 210, I do think Surratt kind of fits closer into that bucket.
Yeah, and I wish there was more film. You know, he lined up in the slot a little bit. I mean, was against Ohio State in the Big Ten championship game. He had that, you know, slot fade touchdown. And I mean, there are examples, but I think it was almost 90% he was lined up outside. So it's you know, clearly where he was used and where probably he's more comfortable. But to your point about, especially against him, against zone, like, this is a good football player. And like, there are a few receivers in this draft that kind of just fall in that bucket for me where, man, maybe not great at this, maybe not, like, you know, there are reasons to look at the profile and say, eh, this might not work, but he's just a good football player. And at some point, the value is there where you're like, you know what, let's roll the dice on the good football player. I mean, Jeremy Bernard, I think, is in that bucket for me where, yeah, there are parts of his profile that you can poke holes in. But at a certain point, just give me the good football player. And I think that's Jeremy Bernard, and I think Surratt's in that category as well.
Yeah, I think there's a ton of those guys at receiver in this class, which will make for really interesting discussion when we do like post-draft fantasy rankings, which you won't have to do, Dane, but I will have to do on this show. And that's going to come down to like, did they land in the right spot? And if they don't, are they going to kind of be, one, are they going to be kind of one of those flameouts that don't really do anything? Or two, can they end up being really good contributing players that if the you know, kind of just breaks fall right for them, they do end up being a really high volume player, which is what we saw for a guy like Amon-Ra St. Brown. What we've seen for some of these players before, that it just, they fell in the right spot. They fell with the staff that knew what to do with them. And I think that path is available for Surratt. Just to put a point on the alignment, I had him in the games that I charted at 88.2% snaps outside, 84.5% came at left wide receiver, which also, by the way, has been like kind of a historical red flag for me, is these guys who only line up on one side of the field, they do sometimes struggle to transition quickly to the NFL. I have 35 receivers. Chris Brazel's got the like highest that I've charted in years. I think it took till the 510th snap that I charted for him to take a snap at left wide receiver, and I'm pretty sure that was, I mean, I could look it up you know, but that's like the only one of the entire sample, which, by the way, Jack Besh was one of those guys too at TCU, only lined up on one side of the field. There's only been, I've done 35 receivers over the course of charting prospects that have fallen into this bucket before this class. And only four of them, I would say, have been like true hits. It's Drake London, DJ Moore, Rashee Rice, and the last one is Juju Smith-Schuster. So two of the guys have been like big slots, and I mean, Drake London's kind of big slot-ish too at the same time. So it's definitely a lot of the dudes who end up being outside receivers. Sometimes you get a somewhat useful player like a Cedric Tillman or Quentin Johnston, but for the most part, it's a lot of guys who, you know, didn't really work out.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating, and it's something that it's not a disqualifier, but it's something that should. You know, your ears should be perked up a little bit, and it's something to consider as we try to, you know, figure all these guys out.
Yeah. And a lot of them, it just kind of says something about the offense and the learning curve that they're going to face, which I do think for Surratt, though, he's such a smart player that I do kind of want to bet on him being one of those outliers, but we'll see. I do like this landing spot for the simple fact that we get to see some of those really cool back shoulder throws between these two guys, Fernando Mendoza and Elijah Surratt, which are objectively really fun to watch. We are going to take our final quick break on the show. When we come back, we're going to get the prospect that Dane is standing on the table for in this year's draft. We'll get into that right after this. All right, we're back, and it is time to get the prospect that Dane Brugler is willing to stand on the table for.
Captain, my captain.
Sit down, Mr. Anderson.
We have Bills Mafia here.
Let's go!
AJ, through the table!
I've heard that segment intro how many times now on this show during draft season, and it does make me laugh every single time. So there is that. Okay, Dane, who is the prospect out of the, I don't know, thousands in the beast that you are standing on the table for in this year's draft?
There are a few names that immediately came to mind when I thought about this, but one that stood apart, and that's Chris Johnson, the corner out of San Diego State, who I first watched him over the summer and was instantly like, all right, we've got a guy here. It's harder and harder to find those group of five players that are real guys. Emmanuel McNeil Warren was also on my short list. Yeah, I think people have passed me. It happens every draft season where I love a guy in September, October.
Sure.
And at some point during the process, I get passed. But I think Chris Johnson, I'm still pretty high up there in terms of, you know, his biggest fans. I just like, because he's so smooth. He can do everything you want. He's 6 foot. One of the questions was how fast was he going to be, which on film, he doesn't look like a burner initially, but I don't think he's slow either. So I wasn't sure how you would test. And talking to scouts, they were kind of worried, like he might be a 4.55 guy. All right, well, he goes to the combine and rips out a 4.40. I mean, he was awesome at the combine in terms of his testing and just showing what he could do movement wise. And then, but you throw on the tape and it's okay. The Cal tape, Northern Illinois tape was awesome. And whatever you want him to do, whether it's playing off, zone, man, like he can do all of those things. I think he's really instinctivized. I like how down to earth he is. And so like after I got done watching him over the summer, put a pretty good grade on him, and then got on the phone with him just to learn more about him and, you know, find out he's a twin and, you know, he's younger for a senior because him and his twin sister skipped kindergarten and like all these, you know, grew up in a Pittsburgh Steelers house. So like all these different things, learning about him was really interesting, but then finding out more about his football IQ and what he looks for in route runners and all these different tidbits, I was like, okay, he's also a very smart player with just how he plays, how he approaches the game, the preparation, and then how that manifests itself on game day. The ability to be in the right spot at the right time and to go make plays. And so Chris Johnson, to me, I think he finishes my third corner in this draft behind Mansoor Delane and Jermon McCoy. And it might maybe even my second corner if McCoy, you know, if I had the medical information in front of me, maybe would even be the second corner based off of what's going on with McCoy. But I just think he's a really good player that's going to fit 32 teams, regardless of what you want to do. He's going to be a fit for, I think, character-wise, athletically, mentally, a lot of it is there for what teams look for at the position.
Yeah, I mean, some of the highlights from the Beast, in addition to some of the, what you're throwing out there, I mean, you mentioned he played special teams all four seasons, which is really cool. Yeah. The quote from an NFL scout that you have in here, that his give up, insert word here, this is a family show, factor is to the moon, leader of the DB room, likable kid, parents did amazing. I'm like, there's a lot to obviously like about the profile here. You mentioned that he's a fit for all 32 teams, which I think is really cool. But you know, when you flag plant a player like this, Dane, I have this stuff obviously with receivers. We've talked about it a ton on the show that like when you see him go to the exact right spot, you're, you know, you sit on there on draft night. I'm sure you guys are doing a show at the Athletic this year. You'd be like, oh hell yeah. Yep. Like this is a perfect spot for him to land. Is there a team that maybe you would think like he'd really fit into this defense?
Realistically speaking, like I think he's going to go somewhere in the back half of round one. And so I think the teams at that point, I would love to see him, you know, whether the Chiefs with Spagnuolo, I think that'd be a lot of fun. I think a lot of the reasons they liked Trent McDuffie was probably the smartest DB prospect that I ever talked to before the draft. Mm. So I think a lot of the reasons they like Trent McDuffie, I think that would be a fit. And then also, like if I'm Miami and I'm totally turning over this roster and I want, you know, just cornerstone guys that we can build this thing out. I think, you know, at pick 30, the pick they got in the Waddle trade from Denver, I think that would make a ton of sense for them. That corners they need, but also more importantly for the Dolphins, they need to get, like I said, cornerstone players that they can really build this thing around. And I think Chris Johnson would make sense.
Yeah, their cornerback room in Miami has been a disaster for, you know, months and months on end now, if not a full 365 days. So that one makes a ton of sense to me. And plus, like, yeah, you got two first round picks. Maybe you earmark 11 for offense. Maybe. But the reality is, like, you need everything. And at the same time, yeah, like, just get a guy like this who's clearly going to be a tone setter there, a building block, a culture setter. That is a really fun move there. I would like that one a lot for Miami. So that's a really good shout out. Chris Johnson, definitely not somebody that we've talked about enough on this show. Dane, appreciate the hell out of you for doing this as we do every year. It's always a really fun exercise. I know that, I mean, if you're listening to this show, if you're watching this show on YouTube, like you probably know what the Beast is, but for those who have not heard about the Beast, Dane, and all the other great work you're doing with the Athletic, tell the people where they can find all your content leading up to the NFL draft.
Yeah, it's all in the Athletic. And, you know, the draft guide is something that if you're interested in the draft at all, whether you're a diehard or you're just a casual fan, it's something that you need at your fingertips for all 3 days of the draft. Or get it now and, you know, read up on some of these guys. I take a lot of pride in all the background information in there, all the scout quotes, all the testing. There's testing information for over 2,700 players, all NFL verified testing information. So it's a labor of love that takes the full year to complete, already started on next year. And it was a lot of fun last week sharing it with everybody. And so to hear all the feedback has been tremendous. And so, yeah, hopefully people check it out.
Yeah, it's awesome, dude. Like I've been diving in on all your receiver profiles and kind of any guys that, okay, Dane's got this guy going a little higher. Like maybe I need to make sure I get a profile on the site on this guy before draft day, stuff like that. One of the guys last year that I almost let slip through the cracks and then ended up getting drafted in the fourth round. And this was kind of a guy that you had a little bit higher than maybe I was thinking was Chimere Dike, obviously the Titans receiver. He goes in the fourth round and he was the final guy, the 28th player that I put on the site last year, just in time. So I appreciate that. See, Dane is on top of things. Yeah. So for the latecomers like me, I got to get to
him. Yeah. He outplayed, I think, what we all thought. I mean, I think what he brought as a return man, especially. But no, you're right. He went to he took advantage of the opportunity because obviously they were looking for someone to, you know, help catch passes from a rookie quarterback. And that turned out okay. And so it'll be interesting to see how the Titans fill out that room this year, because I think they're going to draft a receiver at some point in the draft. It'll just be interesting to see style wise which way they go. But yeah, that's a good show.
Well, as is the case this year with wide receivers, there's plenty of flavors, everything you could possibly need. Dane, appreciate you, man. I know you got plenty to do, so we're going to let you go. Really excited to see what you guys cook up on The Athletic for draft night and everything else that's going on in the Beast. Make sure you get your subscription so you guys can dive into that. As for this show, it's going to do it for another edition of Mock Draft Monday, but we'll be back on Tuesday as Justin Boone joins me for our final edition of Teams That Will Shape the Draft. We're going to look at teams that have 10-plus picks and the teams that have no first-round picks this year. What do they need to do? What can they look to accomplish on April's draft here? Man, this thing is fast approaching, so we got a ton to get into with that show. That's going to be live right here at 2 p.m. Eastern on Tuesday. Until then, we are out.